Genesis 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was out form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens." So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds." And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of all the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth and to every bird of the heavens and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for you." And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation.
Well, thanks very much, Tom. do keep that passage open. I think it'll be really useful just to sort of, we'll be referring to it a little bit, but obviously not dealing with the whole thing. Over the next 3 weeks, as Tom suggested at the beginning there, three foundational building blocks, God, sex, and work, which will spring primarily from this Genesis text. I believe this is where we get the maker's instructions, his design clearly explained for these areas of life. I mean, it's not everything you've ever wanted to know about these subjects, but core truth we need to know to set us off in the right direction, to keep us going in the right direction. Today, though, this familiar creation account, through it all, we meet God, God our maker. And importantly, we meet God on his terms. One of the intended implications of this Genesis text that we've just heard read is to convince the reader that the God who made this world is worthy of our attention, of our devotion. And so there are very few questions as important as the one I put on the top of your handout there. To whom will you give your attention? To whom will you give your attention? I'd like to suggest that's the question that we should be sort of have ringing in our minds by the end of this. You know, is God worthy of our attention given all of this? In his book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, the author, John Mark Comer, he runs a church in California, I think up in San Francisco. As far as I can work out, I haven't finished the book yet. It looks like a good book. And I think he leads a very faithful church. And he wants us to grasp the significance of this question, to whom will you give your attention? He writes this, because what you give your attention to is the person you become. Put another way around, what you fill your mind with will shape the trajectory of your character. In the end, your life is no more than the sum total of what you gave your attention to. That, he continues, does not bode well for those who give their attention to the 24/7 news cycle of outrage and anxiety and emotionally charged drama, the nonstop feed of celebrity gossip, titillation, cultural drivel, etc. And then he adds, as if we give it to them in the first place, much of it is stolen by a clever algorithm out to monetize our precious attention. But again, he concludes, we become what we give our attention to for better or for worse. And so our question, to whom will you give your attention? These opening verses in Genesis give us a vision for God so overwhelmingly mighty and powerful that it's there to grip us, to pull us in. Genesis 1, in a sense, should thrill us. It should hook the reader in to want to know more about God, to win our attention, our affection, our devotion. And I think that's really hard because I guess it's one of the most familiar texts. Looking around the room, I mean, I know you're all familiar with this text, and it's the sort of thing we go to for many different reasons at many times. It is easy to miss the significance of what's going on here. So we're going to try and just draw out a few of the purposes that we see, and hence the big sort of challenge, giving God our attention, devotion. A few words on Genesis as a whole book. Along with the first four books of the Bible, collectively called the Pentateuch, they were written, those five books together, written by Moses. But like all books in the Bible, we believe here at St. Nick's, inspired by God, and therefore to hear Genesis explained is to hear God speak to us. And so here is God speaking to us about God. Also, the word Genesis, what does it actually mean? Well, it just means very simply origins, beginnings. As you read the whole book, you'll find similar word coming up at regular intervals. Just glance to 2 verse 4, you see that similar word, generations. 2 verse 4, these are the generations. And then you see 5 verse 1, that same phrase again, these are the generations. Then 6 verse 9, these are the generations. 9 verse 12, these are the generations. 15 times that comes up through the book of Genesis. That gives us a structure to the whole book, the repeated phrase, like the heartbeat of the whole book. It gives us a clue to the main theme. Generations. Generations of descendants, of people. If you want a single word to sum up the book of Genesis, I believe Genesis is at its heart all about people. But of course, people are established and set apart in God's world for God's purposes, God's pleasure, God's glory. And Genesis shines a light on people. But we're getting ahead of ourselves, of course, because as we open up the book, people haven't been created yet, either as land or even light. I mean, God is about to create the stage full of color, full of surprises, on which the play of human history will take place. But our starting point is before all of that. Genesis 1, verse 1 to 2, verse 3, stands out very clearly as an introduction. And as a piece of writing, it is different to what follows from 2, verse 4 onwards, different genre altogether. It is poetic rather than testimonial. And there's lots of sort of details that help us see that, many repeated words and phrases and ideas. For example, the days provide a sort of rhythm to this section in Genesis. They also provide sort of content, breaking down the displays of God's power and purposes, breaking them down into manageable chunks so that we can sort of digest them. Now, if I'm right by suggesting that Genesis 2 verse 4 onwards is all about people, then the introduction, 1:1 to 2 verse 3, is all about God sort of shining a spotlight on those people going forward. 1 verse 1 to 2 verse 3 is therefore about God himself. The word God appears 35 times in that reading that Tom just read out. And so he's not only our subject, he is our teacher, and he deserves our undivided attention. Remember, that's what we're considering. To whom will you give your attention? So first, three points that I hope will win us or convince us further that God is worthy of all our attention, devotion. First, very obviously, God is powerful. And as you consider those creative acts, if you think about the impact of the words that we just heard, they are absolutely overwhelming, aren't they? Immeasurable power. I think it's easy to talk about power and find it quite hard to get our heads around. It can seem quite sort of existential, unconnected to day-to-day life. I mean, what we're saying is that God is so powerful that he can bring stuff into existence. When God decides, on his terms, darkness is turned to light. The deep abyss of the unformed earth turns to dry, habitable land. Plants, creatures, people appear when God decides. When we make things, we use raw materials and we make a real hash of it, and it takes ages. We've had some of the most professional workmen that I know in London as we've sort of been involved in this project here at St. Nick's, the sort of building project for the last 10 years. I think it was when we first opened up the coffee bar and things 10 years ago. Various builders have come and gone. We've got brilliant builders who've been working in the offices behind the screen here for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks now. And it's taken them a huge amount of time and money. They've sort of sloshed around some incredibly strong paint that's left us all feeling quite high at the end of each day. We've got to spend all our time down here. And what a contrast. What a contrast if we just sort of think about, you know, creating, what do we get at the end? A sort of a minor upgrade. Consider again this passage that we had read. The Lord God took darkness and void, that's how the passage starts, and he made the heavens and the earth. Now that's an upgrade. 6 days, that's all it took. Atoms that didn't exist, exist. And whilst we're on the days, it's a shame, of course, that so many people inside and outside the church get hung up on this word day, 24-hour period or not. Well, it could have been a 24-hour period, and some people may have quite strong views on that. I don't think it's necessary. There are various sort of linguistic problems as to why it may not be 24 hours, not least because, of course, the sun wasn't even created on the first few days. But I don't think it's necessary. I think, importantly, it could have been a long period of time. It could have been a much smaller period of time. Crucially, I mean, a God this powerful doesn't need 24 hours. A nanosecond would be plenty to do the work that God wants to do. And so whatever the sort of the time frame, perhaps what you've been taught in the past, whether it's 24 hours or thousands of years or a split second of some degree, it doesn't make any difference to the point. Here is God powerfully at work. Now, there's a little grid there which shows us what God did. First 3 days, the universe is formed. light and sky and sea and land and vegetation. And then the second panel there, you'll see days 4, 5, and 6, God fills his creation, the moving objects, life, sun and moon and stars, day 4. Sea creatures fill the seas, birds fill the heavens, day 5. Animals of every kind. And then, of course, man and woman, significantly, day 6. I love the little detail on day 4. I wonder if you noticed. End of verse 16, definitely my favorite 3 words, and the stars. God created everything and the stars. I mean, you know what it's like when you look up into the sky and see the sky just lit up. According to Google, 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe. Some are huge, 100 trillion stars in just one of those galaxies. Others are small. Dwarf galaxies hold just 10 million stars, and the stars. And God's power is not just displayed up there. All of creation, we are told, displays God's power. David Attenborough makes those incredible films, doesn't he? I think some of his documentaries are just a little bit strange, some of the conclusions that he makes, and his evolutionary propaganda can be quite tiresome. But he makes some incredible sort of high-quality programs. And I remember one that I was watching some years back now. He was up in a hot air balloon, and he said this as he sort of looked across God's, well, not God's, in his opinion, the sort of the world. And he said, it is impossible not to be impressed by the sheer grandeur, splendor, and power of the natural world. You sort of want to sort of shake him, don't you, and say, well, then draw the logical conclusion, Attenborough. But anyway, did you know that when the Natural History Museum was made, it was designed by William Gladstone. This is the Natural History Museum in London, which is well worth a visit if you're sort of new to London, haven't got there yet. You know, when it was designed, it was built as a cathedral, and it was built as a cathedral to display God's glory. God's glory can be seen in creation. William Gladstone wanted to gather together all of the sort of various acts and specimens of creation to display God's glory. And so the point on power from this first point, how big is your God? I mean, the God of the Bible is imaginative, creative, impressive, terrifyingly powerful. And I think if ever we're tempted to conclude that the Christianity that we have signed up to is somehow boring or dull, it can only be because we haven't given God the attention that he deserves. And even from this passage, that is true. I mean, to somehow think that there could be something more interesting in the created world than the Creator himself. I mean, it would be like, there's a stupid illustration. It would be to think that you could have a better conversation and feeling of fulfillment with a cake than with the baker who made it. It's obvious when you think about it, isn't it? And we're going to be thinking about more in discussion in a few minutes' time. Let's move on, though. Firstly, God is powerful. Secondly, he is personal. And I guess this becomes really clear when we consider how God brings his creation into existence. He doesn't use a magic wand, sort of Harry Potter style. God creates something out of nothing by speaking. And this, of course, makes God personal. By that, I mean God is showing us how he will form intimate relationships with people. It's quite interesting in that text, and God said, that comes up 10 times. And of course, God uses his words to bring his creation into existence. What he says happens. And his words then become the currency of fulfilled life in every respect. They uniquely stand in contrast to the rest of the created order. Humanity has this same ability to speak. No other part of creation can communicate with God. And so words, of course, make personal relationships possible between human beings. But crucially here, God's word makes relationship with him possible. And right at the start of the Bible, God makes that clear as he speaks this world into being. You see, not only does he speak the world into existence as sort of key sort of moments through salvation history happen. Think about the sort of the call of Abraham. God calls Abraham from obscurity to blessing. And that sort of theme continues all through the Bible timeline as God calls individuals into right relationship with him by his word. That is, through the Bible. You might have heard us say this sort of thing here before, but we believe very strongly that when the Bible is taught, because God has invested so much significance in his word, when the Bible is taught, it's like God is in the room reasoning with us, trying to persuade us, trying to get us to personally engage with his agenda. Give me your full attention, God is saying, your full devotion. So first, God is powerful. Secondly, personal. And finally, purposeful. 1 verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Heavens, that's just the sky and everything, the earth, everything below it. God created everything in the beginning, but I just want us to home in on those first three words. In the beginning. You see, the fact that God starts something means there must be a purpose for the beginning. It's like in this opening verse, God is painting a huge great arrow in the sky. And so the logical question must be, you know, where is this pointing to? What is God drawing our attention towards? And we should keep that in mind. As we keep that in mind, the sort of the introduction moves us on logically through the 6 days of creation. And each day sort of acts like a building block, fashioned and placed according to a greater plan. The qualitative comment coming after each day, at the end of each day. And God saw it was good. You see that at the end of verse 10, end of verse 12. God saw that it was good. To see that something was good and then to carry on means there's progress. There's beginning, there's progress, there's further creation, there's progress, there's further creation, and it was good, progress. 10, 12, 18, 21, 25. But then the progress with creation reaches a high point. One act of creation stands out above the rest, and that is the creation of humanity. Look at verse 31. God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Humanity changes, if you like, God's own assessment of his work. Up until now, it's been good. Now, the creation of humanity, very good. We move from a B to an A. And so, I think it's very easy, and I've definitely heard this taught in the past, it's very easy to assume that humanity, therefore, acts as the high point of God's creative purposes. Then humanity was made. Very good. The contrast, and you can see that there is some good argument to be made in that direction. But we are not the goal of God's creative purposes. The creation account continues into chapter 2. God's purposes in creation go beyond the created order. They go beyond humanity into the day of rest. Have a look at 2 verse 1 again. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work he had done. So God blessed the seventh day, made it holy, because on it God rested from all the work that he had done in creation. And so do you see that the big arrow, if you like, that God is painting in the sky, with the progress along the way through the different days, it reaches a point of completion. The work was finished. But the work being finished isn't the end of the story. At the end comes rest. And again, this is further sort of brought to our attention. There was evening, there was morning, the first day, there was evening, there was morning, the second day, there was evening, there was morning, the third day, and so on and so on. When you get to the seventh day, there is no close. The seventh day has a start, but it doesn't end. And so there is a sense in which this rest that happens at the end of God's completed creation work continues to this day. And that raises a lot of very important questions about this rest. What exactly is this rest that God seems to now enter into on day seven? Is it something that we, humanity, can be part of or share in? What does it look like? How does that happen? That's something to bear in mind. We'll come back to that in a moment. But before we do, it's just worth, this is really the heartbeat of this final point. I want us to see significantly, you see, when God creates, there was a beginning. And the beginning builds to a goal. This means, of course, that God created this world with purpose. And there was a purpose for us to see, for us to experience as a purpose for which God made us. There is, therefore, a reason why we exist today, a reason for life. Richard Dawkins, much quoted in all sorts of ways, one of his first books, slightly lesser well-known, it's called River Out of Eden. So right at the beginning of his sort of atheistic writing, he wrote this: the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. I find it pretty amazing that people like Richard Dawkins are not only prepared to put words of such hopelessness down on paper, but are prepared to stand by them and to encourage others to sign up to their agenda too. Pitiless indifference is his conclusion on this world. But you see, the Genesis account that we just heard read offers a direct challenge to this type of philosophy. God's creative design builds to a goal. And this goal, in this Genesis account, is a goal that God enjoys himself. He enters into it and he does not leave his rest. Creation work complete. Rest entered into. Rest continues. What this means, I'm just trying to think about the significance of this, and this is pretty much as we're going to start to sort of draw to a close now. So this is the last sort of big point to get our heads around. What this means is that we're being introduced to a God who is purposeful in what he does. That means, of course, as we look at the created world, he isn't going to keep sort of tweaking his creation and making it slightly different, redoing bits here and there. I mean, we have to do little sort of minor upgrades all the time, don't we, to the sort of the living environments in which we are. God is not going to do that to his world. He has finished creating it. He was pleased with it, and it ended on day six. It has reached the goal that God wanted. It is certain. It is focused. And so if God can be so intentional, if God can create with such clear purpose, then the question that we must be asking is, what purpose does God have for us if we're part of that plan? We're just going to carry this thinking on a little bit further. You see, before long, the Sabbath, the seventh day, became enshrined into the law to help God's people understand the reason for which they were made. God's people, Israel, they're established as a nation. They're commanded, just after they're pulled out of Egypt, they're commanded to participate in the Sabbath. Let's just go here. Exodus chapter 31. I didn't write down a page number. Next book of the Bible, Exodus chapter 31. And that's on page 72. So on page 72, and I'll read from verse 12. So all God's people, they've been taken out of Egypt. They've gone through a little bit of the desert. They come to Sinai. The law has been given, and it's currently being explained. And there's a little bit more explanation here that's between the Lord God and Moses. And Moses is sort of writing down all of the explanations. And the Lord God said this to Moses, verse 12, "You are to speak to the people of Israel and say, 'Above all, you shall keep my Sabbaths. For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you.'" That means make you holy, set you apart. Verse 14, "You shall keep the Sabbath because it is holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death.
whoever does not, whoever does any work on it, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. I guess if you were a corporate lawyer back in those days, or even pretty much any city profession, certainly if you're a teacher doing a school trip or marking essays, I mean, that would be it. Under the old covenant, you wouldn't last long, would you? Sabbath days, put to death. Look at verse 16. Therefore, the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generation as a covenant forever. It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. And on the seventh day, he rested and was refreshed. I've always found the Sabbath quite a hard subject to get my head around, and it's been really refreshing, actually, getting into it a little bit in preparation for all of this. I think the point is this, you see, by not working, Israel was commanded right from the beginning of time, so to speak, certainly from the beginning of sort of the gathered church community relating rightly to God. Right from the beginning, Israel was forced to consider that the basis of their existence was not in what they did, but in a God who had made them and sustained them. God had rescued them. God had brought them out. God was providing them. And God said, "You shall rest." And on that day, they were forced to consider who they were in God's hands. Now, that is the old covenant. That doesn't apply today. Under the new covenant, Jesus takes the Sabbath command to its logical fulfillment. And he says, of course, we find our rest not by observing a day off each week, but primarily we find this rest by being in right relationship with him. You'll see that quote on the handout there, Matthew 11, verse 28. "Come to me," says Jesus, "all who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest." For historic Israel, who had read their Bibles faithfully, those words must have been one of the most sort of surprising revelations ever to have heard. Jesus, the source of the rest that they had been promised and they were looking forward to. And so keeping the Sabbath today is not first and foremost about working 6 days out of seven and resting one. It's about, of course, coming to know Jesus and resting in him. I've tried to write down on the handout so that it doesn't become too confusing. What does that rest mean exactly? Well, there's a now element to that rest, which of course happens as we come to know Jesus, conversion, and then as we find contentment in him. There is, of course, a future element to that rest. It's not fully realized yet. There's a now and not yet. The future element, well, we enjoy God's purposes in the future, in the new creation, when, of course, we will be with Jesus in God's rest for eternity. And so this is how our purpose in existing is connected to God's purpose in creating. Let me just say that again. This is how our purpose in existing, what are we doing here, is connected to God's purpose in creation. God created with the goal of rest. I have a purpose, and I want to invite a people to come and join me in that rest. Jesus makes that possible. So the big point for us, the God who made this world, wants us to see that he has a clear, intended purpose, design for us. Of course, though, as I hope is really clear, that is not going to be found, that purpose, that design, is not going to be found in the created world, in our activities, in our work, in our relationships, in our play. The purpose for which we were made is to find rest, and that means coming to Jesus. And so, if Jesus is not the heartbeat of your everyday, you will find life frustrating, in the end futile. Lewis Carroll captures this brilliantly in Alice in Wonderland. You remember the days when you read Alice in Wonderland way, way back? Doesn't matter if you haven't read it. The quote will make sense. Cat, speaking to Alice, "Where are you going?" Alice, "Which way should I go?" Cat, "Well, that depends on where you are going." Alice, "I don't know." Cat, "Then it doesn't matter much which way you go." Genesis points us to God's purpose, to our purpose, And of course, by introducing us to a God who designed this world and created us for the purpose of his Sabbath rest, we know where we are going. It does matter where we go. So God has purpose. Well, look, there's some stuff to think about. Let me just sort of draw to some sort of conclusion here. A summary. This is all to win our attention to God. God demands our attention. He's worthy of our attention. He has power out of this world proportions. Wonderfully, he is available for intimate personal relationship. He speaks. He's made us able to speak. He communicates and raises up people today through his word. It is the currency of our existence and the currency of this world that he created. And he has purpose in creating, that final point. Not in the created things, but the purpose tied up with his rest. And so, again, as you come in from work, as you consider this term ahead and all of that, think about what your purpose, your reason for existing is. If it's been captured, if your heart has been captured, your attention somehow sort of quashed by the pursuit of stuff or the pursuit of just things that are temporary, well, the answer from Genesis, you're missing everything. So to whom? To whom will you give your attention?